And now we turn from baseball to monkey business. Most groundbreaking experiments in economics are performed by economists, as you would expect. But a scientist called a primate ethologist has added to the sum total of economic knowledge, at least as it applies to monkeys, and maybe to us. Alex Bloomberg of our Planet Money team has the story.
You're on the low end of the social order. You toil and toil, yet make hardly any money for your efforts. Is there a way for you to improve your lot, bump up your earning potential, if you're a monkey?
We were trying to answer questions about whether monkeys are able to behave in an economic way.
This is Dr. Ronald Noe, a primate ethologist at the University of Strasbourg. His question specifically was, what would happen if he trained a low-ranking vervet monkey to do things that other vervet monkeys, even high-ranking monkeys, couldn't do? Now, vervet monkey society is pretty hierarchical. High-ranking monkeys get groomed a lot, but hardly ever have to groom other monkeys. Low-ranking monkeys groom others, but never get groomed themselves. Dr. Noe's team trained a low-ranker to open a container with bits of apples in it, a skill that no other monkey had. Would it be worth anything, he wondered, in monkey money, otherwise known as grooming?
It has some aspects of money. The high-rankers can give other services that low-rankers can't give, such as support in a fight or a tolerance around a food site or something like that. And they get rewarded for that by grooming often.
I see. Okay. Tolerance around the food site. In other words, they can
decide whether or not a low ranker is allowed to feed next to them or not. If they don't like it, they hit him over the head. If they like it, they...
So it's a protection racket in a certain way.
We see it in a slightly more positive way. They're nice to each other and groom each other. But of course, they also hit each other over the head once in a while. That's for sure.
Sure enough, when they trained a low-ranking monkey to open the container, just as any technical college advertisement will tell you, the new skills translated into a higher income. Roughly an hour after she'd opened the container for everyone, she was getting groomed a lot more, as much as a high-ranking monkey, and she no longer had to do hardly any grooming herself. But that was not the most spectacular finding.
So what we then did is we got a second low-ranking female, trained her to open a second container, with apples in it. And then we saw that the value of the first provider dropped more or less to the half of what she had before. So now we had a competition between two animals. Both of them could provide these apples. And so the value of the first one dropped down again. And of the second one, who was very low at the beginning of the experiment, she went up, and they ended up both in the middle, so to speak.
So, when there was a monkey monopoly on the skill, the monkeys paid one price. But when it became a duopoly, the price fell to an equilibrium point, about half of what it had been. And this all happened despite the fact that we're talking about monkeys here. Monkeys can't do math.
Animals that cannot form binding contracts, animals that cannot talk about what they want to do or cannot offer verbally or anything, they nevertheless are quite accurate in adapting their behavior to what the market gives them.
Dr. Noe says that monkeys arrive at these economic outcomes not through sitting down and negotiation, but through feeling and emotion. Monkeys develop positive associations towards a container-opening member of their society, and they just want to groom her. But once another monkey can open the container, the skill isn't as unique, the positive feelings diminish, and grooming goes down. It's the law of supply and demand played out along the neurohormonal pathways that deal with emotion in the monkey brain. Dr. Noe wonders how much of human economics operates along similar lines. As he puts it, even on the stock market, people might play more with their bellies than with their brains. For NPR News, I'm Alex Bloomberg.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. We have a reminder this morning of just how complicated it can be to fight global warming. Anti-global warming rules now in effect may actually encourage people to cut down forests. That news comes just as we prepare for a lot of talk about climate change. The Senate is debating an energy bill next week. And in December, Copenhagen will host a global conference on climate. Officials may have to give thought to a finding in today's Science magazine. It focuses on biofuels, which are made from plants. Current laws on biofuels have unintended consequences, which in turn make climate change worse. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
If you burn ethanol from corn in your car, the government doesn't count the carbon dioxide that comes out the tailpipe as an actual carbon emission. That's because they figure the corn plant originally took that carbon dioxide out of the air, so you're just putting it back. But 13 prominent scientists point out in Science magazine that's bad logic when it comes to many types of biofuels. Author Tim Serchinger is from Princeton University, and he offers an extreme example to make the point.
Even if you were to cut down the world's forests and turn them into a parking lot and take the wood and put it in a boiler, which obviously releases enormous amounts of carbon in the trees, that is treated as a pure way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And that's obviously an error.
And that error isn't trivial. It's now enshrined in European law as well as the Kyoto Climate Treaty.
The problem is that when the world agreed to a treaty that limited the amount of carbon that goes up the smokestack, they didn't agree to limit the amount of carbon released by cutting down trees.
Serchinger explains that in an effort to avoid double counting carbon emissions, the treaty negotiators ended up with a system that never counts them at all. And he says the climate bill that passed the U.S. House of Representatives earlier this year makes basically the same error, though at the moment the Senate bill does have forest safeguards in place. As a result of this accounting error, countries trying to reduce their carbon emissions actually have an incentive to cut down forests and burn them up, or replant the area with biofuels crops. In fact, Serchinger says power plants in Northern Europe are starting to chip up wood and burn it for energy in the name of reducing emissions.
The fundamental effect of this flaw is to make forests worth more dead than alive.
This spring, another report in Science magazine pondered what would happen in the coming decades if biofuels carbon was never counted as an emission. Jay Edmonds at the Pacific Northwest National Lab says they calculated that almost all the world's forests would be chopped down by the middle of this century.
You can't actually imagine this thing going on like this with no one noticing and no one stepping in to intervene, but the numerical experiment is instructive in that it takes the phenomena into sharp relief.
The good news is it's very easily fixable.
Again, Tim Serchinger. He says nations simply need to count all carbon dioxide coming out of tailpipes and smokestacks, regardless of the source. Then, if the source of the biofuel was a destructive one, like deforestation, there would be no carbon emissions credit. But if it was from a good source, like plants grown on previously barren land, that would earn a carbon credit.
So there are substantial amounts of bioenergy we can make that do give us greenhouse gas benefits. What we don't want to do is create a false and perverse incentive simply to go clear the world's forests.
Whether this new accounting scheme would affect the domestic biofuels industry is debatable. Bob Dineen, president of the Renewable Fuels Association, says it shouldn't matter.
Some of the points that have been made in the paper today we agree with. You should never, under any circumstance, tear down a forest for the growing of a biofuel.
But some scientists argue that the domestic biofuels industry does indirectly lead to deforestation in the tropics by raising the global price of corn and encouraging farmers in South America to clear land to plant grain. Jay Edmonds from the Pacific Northwest National Lab says if we could place a cash value on preserving forests, that ends up being good for the atmosphere.
You end up not producing quite as much biofuel, but then you don't need as much because you don't have to make up for the deforestation.
The real challenge now, Edmonds says, is figuring out how to put a new carbon accounting system into practice. Richard Harris, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris in Washington.
And I'm Alyssa Block, hosting This Week and Next from NPR West, with a story today about a much-loved local institution in Portland, Oregon. A chain of grocery stores that everybody there kept raving about. Listen to shoppers Robin Johnson, Andy Kerr, and Helen Abernathy.
The staff is great. They're very welcoming, very helpful. It's just fun to go in there.
I used to go to Whole Foods all the time, but I like this place better. They just because they seem to have better service and selection.
The people in there are absolutely the friendliest in town.
It's New Seasons Market, and its slogan is, in fact, the friendliest store in town.
What can I get for you?
Can I get a pound of the chuck steak?
You most certainly may. How many people are you feeding?
There are 9 New Seasons stores around Portland, 2 more on the way.
There you go. I'll see you next time. Oh, it's my pleasure.
The store emphasizes local meat, sustainable fish, lots of local and organic produce, tagged with yellow, homegrown labels. And one thing shoppers will tell you is they like that New Seasons is locally owned. It was started 10 years ago by Brian Roeder.
And we had a great garden this year.
We meet Brian Roeder at his Portland home. His front lawn has been torn up, turned into a vegetable garden. Out back, there are chickens. But we don't stay long at the house. Brian Roeder, wearing jeans and a green T-shirt, straps on a helmet and does what lots of people in Portland do. He bikes to work.
So I'll see you there.
We meet up again a few miles away at one of his New Seasons markets and start walking around.
We do lots of things differently. It's a little bit of an alternate universe here.
And on the shelves, you see right away what sets New Seasons apart from, say, Whole Foods or Trader Joe's.
I mean, this is actually an interesting aisle to go in right here just because it gives you a sense of what this store is all about.
Yeah, I'm standing here in the cookie and chip aisle, and I'm thinking I could be right now in a Safeway. I'm seeing double stuffed Oreos on my right, Fritos scoops
right.
on my left.
Exactly. And then if you move down the aisle here, you'll see that it shifts, and it goes into the natural foods brands, the Barbara's and the Newman's Own. And so that's a lot of what this store is that we know that people aren't perfect. And we know that people want to eat good food, but they also want their Doritos and they also want their Oreo cookies. We're not the food police. We want to offer what people want.
So Skippy peanut butter, Diet Coke, they've got that, along with the tofurkey.
We recognize the reality of what people's eating habits are, and we offer them lots of fresh, healthy choices. And we find that over time, when they try those things, they end up liking them more, and they move in that direction. So we think that we're a positive force for change by moving people in the right direction. But on the other hand, if you like double-stuffed Oreos, you like double-stuffed Oreos, and as long as you don't eat the whole box of them and you have a couple of them for a treat, there's really no big harm in that.
Eat and let eat is how Brian Roeder describes his philosophy, with a few exceptions.
There's a few products that we say are iconic in their awfulness.
So New Seasons doesn't sell tobacco products or 40-ounce malt liquor, no industrial-raised veal, and no farmed salmon, which Roeder calls an environmental disaster. We are, after all, in Oregon, Salmon Nation. The prices, you do hear some shoppers complain about that.
We're trying to make this a shopping experience that's affordable for all sorts of people. We're trying to democratize quality local foods.
You think that's true? You don't think there would be people, a tight income who would say, there's this incredible special at Safeway this week that New Seasons just can't match?
No, I don't think that's true at all. One of the things is that may be that Safeway may have a special this week that New Seasons can't match for some products. And at the same time, New Seasons Market is going to have a special that Safeway can't match. People might spend more money here because they get tempted.
Besides what's on the shelves, New Seasons prides itself on its customer service. More than two people online, they'll open up another check stand. Don't like something? You'll get your money back, even without a receipt. You're a senior or in the military, you'll get a discount once a week.
I think that our favorite one, though, is our special request policy, and it's just the word yes. And so basically, we'll just do what people want.
Which could mean opening up all the jars of chocolate sauce for a customer to taste so he can decide which one he wants.
True story. Absolutely happens all the time. There's a lot of stories like that.
As for the workers, there's no union. Brian Roeder says there's never been a request for one. Pay starts at $10 an hour. That's well above the state minimum. If you work at least one shift a week, you and your family get health coverage. The company pays 50% of the premium if you work under 20 hours a week. It pays 80% if you work more. And New Seasons does profit sharing with employees. 20% of after-tax profits go back to the workers.
Hey, my friend.
How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
As he walks through the store, Brian Roeder greets a lot of workers by name. Many have been here from the start. But as the company has grown from one store and 70 people in the beginning to 9 stores, 1,700 workers, and 25,000 customers a day now, it's harder to stay connected. And that's why if a customer sends an email to New Seasons, Brian Roeder will read it.
I learn things about what's going on in the company that I wouldn't know about if I didn't read these things.
Roeder is 55, and his connection with food goes way back to soon after he left home at 17.
So I graduated from high school at 7 o'clock, and I left Chicago at 7:30.
Hitchhiking. He was pulled west by a book.
My brother had given me a copy of Ken Kesey's Sometimes a Great Notion, and I read that book, and Oregon was like a beacon of hope for me as I made it through those last months of school. And so I ended up wandering out to Oregon.
To a little town outside Eugene, Oregon, where he did what people did in the early 70s, started a communal farm.
And it was called Mud Farm. About all we knew how to do was create a bunch of mud.
But eventually they figured out the farming thing. Brian Roeder moved on to start a natural meat market, ran a grocery chain, and then started New Seasons. Roeder is interested in the politics of food. He believes maintaining local agriculture is important to community security. About 40% of New Seasons products are locally produced. He thinks linking responsible rural producers and interested urban eaters is good for everyone, and that even in this economy, it can pay off.
It's 2009. It's the worst economic conditions that I've ever seen in all my years of being in business, and we're going to have our best year ever. And so I think that our business model is strong and sustainable, and the fact that we've made it through 2009. We haven't laid off one staff member. And so it's working.
Working, and he hopes a model for communities everywhere.
We don't want to be an alternative grocery store. We want to be the new mainstream grocery store. That's really what we're working towards. And I would imagine that almost anywhere, people want to go to a store where the people working in the store are having a good time. The people shopping in the store are treated respectfully. There's local quality food for sale. The prices are affordable. I mean, what's not to love about that?
What do you got going on today?
Oh, making some homemade chili. In this hot weather.
Yeah, it's supposed to
be hot
enough.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. One thing you can say about high school football, it is not an experience soon forgotten. Boys, mostly, on the cusp of adulthood, enter a world of danger and camaraderie and competition. Now, as part of our series Friday Night Lives, the story of a man whose high school football experience happened decades ago, but for him, it remains vivid and special, even though football has left a dark cloud over his life. Our story comes from NPR's Tom Goldman.
So where are we now, George?
Sacramento.
George Visger is on a journey. He's driving a silver Dodge pickup truck from home, Grass Valley, California, to Stagg High School in Stockton. It's a trip 2 hours south and 35 years back to when Visger was a star lineman for the Stagg Delta Kings.
I get goosebumps going down there every year.
Goosebumps, tears, laughter, it all pours out when George Visger makes the journey back, be it in his truck or in his mind. Here's a guy who played in a college bowl game, who was a member of a Super Bowl-winning NFL team. But it's the stories about Stagg High that Visger loves to tell with crystal clarity and passion, especially from his senior year, 1975. The story that trumps all is when the father of starting running back Fred Douglas was murdered the week of one of the biggest games of the season. The whole team went to the funeral on a Thursday. No one expected Douglas to play Friday, right up until the moment he appeared, minutes before kickoff.
And I'll never forget, he comes in the locker room and he's got his bag of gear over his shoulder, and all he said was, "I just thought you boys might need me tonight. I couldn't let you down." And I'm telling you, it's hard for me to even talk about it, you know, 35 years later. Without getting emotional, but there wasn't a dry eye in the locker room.
I'm so.
Ohio, Ohio! Yeah! Yeah! Visgar's eyes have dried by the time he gets to the Stag High practice field to watch the 2009 Delta Kings. Not that it matters, because the players aren't looking in his eyes anyway.
Dang! That's nice, man.
They're ogling the rings on Visgar's left hand, one from the 1977 Orange Bowl when he was a starting defensive tackle for the University of Colorado. And the main attraction on his right hand, the diamond-encrusted 1982 Super Bowl ring when he was a member of the champion San Francisco 49ers.
It's got an ounce of gold in it.
Visgar puts on the rings for occasions like this. He's been asked to speak to the team after practice. His speech is laced with vivid memories of decades-old high school glory. The irony, the cruel irony, is when you spend time talking to George Visgar, you also get this.
And today, when I was at the, I think it was today, right? When I was at the TV, I'm trying to remember when it was today, right?
The interview.
Yes, thank you.
Laughter is one coping mechanism for his dwindling short-term memory. The small yellow notebooks Visgar stuffs in the back pocket of his Levi's are another.
So here's Monday still.
The notebooks are George Visgar's memory, a daily log of conversations that otherwise would be lost. It's just one of the symptoms of a brain battered by football. Visgar's first concussion was at 13, pre-high school. His coach at the time had the players do a drill called Bull in the Ring. Two guys on opposite sides of a circle, a ball in the middle. First guy to the ball wins.
We just put our heads down and ran at each other full speed from 25 yards, you know. Top of head, which, you know, was crazy.
Young George Visgar was knocked unconscious and hospitalized. By his estimate, he went on to have hundreds, if not thousands, of concussions during his 12 years playing football. Most not as severe as the first, but they took a toll. In the early 1980s, Visgar says team doctors for the San Francisco 49ers told him his episodes of pounding headaches, projectile vomiting, temporary loss of sight and hearing were due to high blood pressure. Reached this week, the 49ers said it wasn't proper to comment since they have no firsthand knowledge of Visgar's medical history. In fact, Visgar had developed hydrocephalus, where excess fluid accumulates in and around the brain. It has led to 9 brain surgeries. The first one prevented him from playing in that 1982 Super Bowl with the 49ers. But he still got a ring. Hey, fellas, I don't mean to bring the party down, but have any of you ever had a concussion?
No, sir.
We're back in George Visgar's pickup. He's driving a few of the Stag players to their homecoming parade. Visgar listens as Stuart Belil, an offensive tackle, acknowledges some symptoms, but not, in his mind, a concussion.
Like, when you hit someone, like, there's always, like, sparkly things if you hit them hard enough, and that's a pretty good feeling because you know you got them.
You know, those are mild forms of concussion now is what they're considering concussions. Back when I played, it was you're either unconscious or stumbling around. And
can't remember.
Concussion education and treatment have improved since Visgar's high school days. Stag players say they know the risk as much as teenage boys can know risk. Sean Mayo is a senior defensive end.
You love football, and it doesn't really matter what happens. Just go after it.
Just go after it. Man up. The kind of football attitudes that George Visgar used over the years to shrug off his health problems. But lately, he's been worried. The symptoms have been getting worse. Not just his memory, but he's getting more easily distracted. It's taking longer to finish the reports he prepares as a wildlife biologist. And Visgar's biggest fear, flashes of anger that are taking their toll on his wife Christy, a school teacher, and his young children.
And my wife works her tail off at school. She'll be there till 10 or 11 or midnight sometimes. My kids are staying there with her now sometimes, almost that late. Chrissy's telling me now, well, they're afraid to come on with me.
This week, George Visgar was in Southern California for an extensive brain evaluation. The news was not good. The neuropsychiatrist who studied Visgar, Dr. Daniel Amen, says Visgar's brain is damaged to such an extent that he'll get dementia in the next 5 years if they don't try to reverse his condition. Visgar says he's extremely enthused about Dr. Amen's treatment plan, a combination of improved sleep habits, better diet, and the right medicine. Still, He admits a sense of urgency in accomplishing things now, like raising awareness about hydrocephalus, promoting concussion education, speaking on behalf of other NFL retirees with long-term health problems, and, of course, loving Stagg High School football. Next month, he'll be back in Stockton cheering for some old teammates as they're inducted into the Stagg High Hall of Fame. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Even if you miss the store openings, you have a chance to catch a movie opening this weekend. Film critic Kenneth Turan would like to suggest a martial arts offering. Ong Bak Choo.
Bruce Lee is dead, Jackie Chan and Jet Li are slowing down, but the world of martial arts never sleeps. It's Tony Jaa who's keeping everyone awake these days. He's Thailand's biggest action hero, and he returns to inflict more damage in Ong Bak Choo, The Beginning. Now, you might think that this film has some connection to the original Ong Bak of a few years back, but you would be wrong. The only thing that links these two pictures is its star, who's such a big deal in the action world that The Hollywood Reporter called Ong Bak Choo arguably the most anticipated Thai movie ever. It was especially anticipated because Jaa disappeared for a time during shooting. Not to worry. He reemerged after a bout of self-described meditation to say he was A-OK and ready for renewed combat. The plot here is rudimentary at best. It begins with a teenage boy on the run in the year 1431. He ends up in a slave market, where he butts heads with tattooed evildoers and goes one-on-one with an enormous crocodile. This catches the eye of a bandit king, who decides to train the lad in martial arts. Clearly, it's not the story, but Tony Jaa's graceful moves that are the biggest attraction in Ong Bak Choo. This time around, his co-conspirators are a group of elephants. Seeing him leaping nimbly along the backs of a thundering herd of the beasts is impressive. Definitely don't try this at home, even if there are elephants in your backyard. The producers claim Ong Bak Choo features kung fu, judo, several kinds of Thai boxing, and something completely new, a combination of Thai dancing and martial arts called Nata Youth, which Jaa invented just for this movie. No wonder taking time off to meditate seemed like a good idea.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. You can find more movie reviews at NPR.org, including one of the new biopic about Amelia Earhart.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris in Washington.
And I'm Melissa Block at NPR West in California. It's been a week of long lines and frustration as swine flu spreads across the country and a lot of people who want the vaccine can't get it. We're going to hear about some of those frustrations and about widespread school closings. We begin with NPR's Joanne Silberner, who's in Atlanta. That's home of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And Joanne, what's the latest you're hearing from the CDC?
Well, the big issue this week has been vaccine availability. Tom Frieden's the head of the Centers for Disease Control, and he talked about the vaccine situation today at a press conference, and the very first thing he said was that while vaccine availability is increasing, it's increasing far too slowly, and he said it was very frustrating. And there's a second issue, which is how quickly the virus is spreading. He talked about that today, too. And also the Department of Education put out a report saying there's twice as many kids out of school today as there was yesterday. It's still a really tiny percentage of the number of students, but the point is it's growing.
And when Tom Frieden talks about the vaccine availability increasing but far too slowly, why is that? What's going on with the production?
Well, first let me say it became available before anyone expected, a couple of weeks early, but the production is slow. And the problem is the vaccine virus is, it just is growing slowly. And for reasons that are known only to the virus, it's just not as fast as others. There are some viruses that grow quickly, some slowly, and this happens to be a slower one. Some manufacturers are doing a little bit better than others. It's not anything to do with safety, it's just how quickly this thing is growing in culture.
You mean for the manufacturers themselves?
Right.
Well, how much vaccine is out there right now?
Well, as of Wednesday, it was 14.1 million doses. Now, 11.3 million of that's already been shipped out to the states. The government at one point was aiming for 40 million doses by the end of this month, and that's clearly not going to happen. They're still saying that there'll be much more around in November and December.
But obviously, swine flu is here now. It's very widespread. Has it reached anything nearing a peak?
Well, how about if I tell you that next year? I mean, no one can tell when a peak comes until it's after it's over. And even if it does start to slide down, even if there are fewer cases, you never know when it's going to come back. I mean, the flus do come back, rarely, but they do. I hate to compare this to the 1918 flu because that one was a deadly one, very deadly. This one is much less often a problem like that. But that came back twice after the first run-through.
Joanne, it has been a big concern for the government, convincing people that the H1N1 vaccine is safe. But we are now, as we mentioned, hearing about these long lines, people who want the vaccine and can't get it. How big a challenge is the safety issue for the people at the CDC?
It's a great big challenge. And there's a real irony here because the government officials are really trying to convince people to accept the vaccine at the same time. They're saying there's not enough around. The really big issue here is pregnant women because they're much more likely to have serious problems. They're six times more likely to die if they get infected. And in fact, today, three physicians groups, including the obstetricians group, just sent out messages to all their members saying to get their pregnant patients, to really urge them to get the vaccine.
Okay, NPR's Joanne Silberner in Atlanta. Thank you.
Thank you.